ability to articulate what's going on, I find incredibly offensive. And to this day, the majority of media in this country are composed of white Americans, and it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. I feel like, for me, those things will not change without a real structural change, which is what Black Lives Matter were addressing, which is how do we change the structure so that we're not being the victims and the focus of violence. And part of changing those structures is critiquing the origin stories of those social structures, which include white supremacy, and using the data that supports that this is actually happening, and from research on redlining and to research on police brutality. You know, this is, you know, even recent stories I've seen about how even a well-to-do black couple were trying to sell their house, and when they got a $300,000 less sort of estimate for the value of the house, when they had their white friends of theirs go and present themselves as the owners, the value went up. And so so this is all money that's being and being stolen from black families, the wealth that they could grow, and being given to white families. And without this, you know, without centering that and really analyzing it and not backing away and not letting Republican strategists just begin to sort of talk over that analysis and present their talking points that are often unrelated to what's really happening in their own party, you know, which is that the MAGA Republicans have taken over. They can't stop it, even when they throw millions of dollars trying to stop those candidates. And what does that say about these Americans who are voting for them? And we've gone through the demographic data of exit polls, and it is very alarming. So I'm at the end of my time here. I just wanted to thank you again. This has been Jacqueline Keeler. An American Standoff, and I think I might try and do a more positive show next week. I know the topics can be very dense and very maybe dispiriting. So thank you so much.
We'll make a space in the lives that we'd planned, and he will stay until it's time for you to go. Yes, we're different. Worlds apart, we're not the same.
This is Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my email. It is often mentioned as one of the most progressive and daring stations that we have in this country. They are not afraid to tell you the truth. So tune in to KBOO Portland and get the real word.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting...
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Portland's favorite talk radio at 8 on Fridays returns at 8 on Friday, September 16th. Tammy and Althea are back to bring you thoughtful insights, colorful commentary, activist interviews, and community conversation. Minding it, bridging it, filling it in. The Gap returns to KBOO on Friday, September 16th at 8 a.m.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Me say me ready for the road. Put me pon the radio, me ready for the road. We no come for players, so me touch the stage show. Fire dust and blaze, so them never they know. KBOO run the place, no, 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 yeah. Yeah, man, I'ma say this is the KBOO Full Strength Community Radio. And you know it's Kabaka Pyramid representing and Full Dawson. Baby Rock family, you don't know Kingston, Jamaica, we say. Yeah, Portland.
Today's show includes references to sex and sexuality. Welcome to Between the Covers, interviews about books with the people who write them, here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Avi Marr, your host this week. Cami DeLouis was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. She holds a degree in photojournalism from San Francisco State University, where she also taught photography. Her work as a documentary photographer has taken her to Russia, inside ambulances, strip clubs, and other public and private worlds. Her work has shown in London's Tate Modern, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, New York's New Museum of Contemporary Art, San Francisco Camerawork Gallery, and with the Wright Art Gallery in Los Angeles, among other places. She was awarded the New York Times Award for Excellence in Photojournalism, the Greg Robinson Memorial Photojournalism Scholarship, and was honored to attend the Eddie Adams Workshop. Her photo essay book, $5 for 3 minutes, documents her time in her early 20s as a stripper in San Francisco. Welcome to Between the Covers, Cami DeLouis.
Hi, thanks.
So, Cami, you grew up in the Bay Area. Can you tell me a little bit about your mom and dad and growing up there?
Yeah, I was born in San Francisco, and we moved around a little bit in the area. Okay, let's start with my dad, because that's the big one. my dad's from Iran. He grew up in a strict Baha'i family in Iran. But in 1960, somehow he was able to come to America, Oregon, in fact, and go to university. And that's when he met my mom, who was 16 at the time. She was, you know, blonde, blue-eyed American girl from LA and a Baha'i, and they hit it off, and she married him at 17. They studied in Oregon, and then they moved to the Bay Area, and then they had me first. And then later I had two other sisters. So that's, in a nutshell, that's the easy.
Well, what was it like to grow up with the conservative Iranian dad?
Yeah, it was fine until it wasn't fine. So there was always this tension, because he came to America thinking he was going to raise Iranian children, but it doesn't work that way. When you immigrate and have children, your children are of that place, unless you work really hard to keep them within your own culture. And I know some people are able to do that, but my mom spoke English, and actually she learned Farsi because she's incredibly smart and amazing with languages, but they used Farsi as a secret language for themselves and didn't teach me and my sisters how to speak it. So naturally, my sisters and I were just like totally American. But the way that it would come out is he would try and control how we dressed, you know, tried to get us to wear like kind of not conservative, but like, you know, feminine pictures of us. And I had obviously been crying, but I'm wearing the damn dress, you know, because we had had a battle like for half an hour beforehand while he tried to shove me into this dress, you know.
Why do you think your parents kept Farsi as a language just where they spoke to each other?
I always wonder that because I so wish I could speak Farsi. But I guess, you know, as parents, it is sort of a secret weapon because you can discuss things without, you know, you can discuss, should we go to the zoo or should we just stay home, without the kids going, yeah, yeah, zoo, 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 like that, you know. So that was fine. And there were Iranian people around us and stuff, but it didn't become a huge issue until the revolution in Iran. And my relatives, who were pretty radical Baha'is in Iran, like feminists, and just being a Baha'i in Iran is a radical act, and punishable now. And so they had to escape Iran. And my dad did all that he could to get them out of there. And a lot of them moved in with us. So, and I was about 10, I think, at the time. So we had this, you know, kind of like American life, except my dad was a little bit weird, you know. But then suddenly, all of Iran moved into our house and like didn't speak English. And so we had my grandpa, my grandma, my aunt, and then whole bunches of cousins and aunts and uncles who lived nearby. And suddenly my sisters and I were like foreigners in our own home. So we, not only were we too American, but also we couldn't understand a word of what was going on. I mean, in the end, my brain did absorb a lot of it. And so to this day, I still kind of understand stuff just because I was young and it was around me. And I recently started studying Farsi just to kind of finally learn it. But yeah, it was hard. And then with that came the pressures on my dad to, I guess he might have been sort of embarrassed in front of his family at how Western his daughters were. And we weren't Baha'i, like none of us were really into it. And that was extreme because my grandfather and my grandmother, they were Orthodox Jews in Iran. But in their young years, they converted to Baha'i. And like, that's really radical. So the family split, they got kicked out of the family, all this stuff. So the Baha'i thing in my family is intense. It's really, you know, when you make a decision that big and you're outcast from the family, you like double down. You know what I mean? Things happened, like, for instance, okay, my mom was still living with us then because the divorce hadn't happened yet. But, you know, when suddenly my grandfather was in the house, this patriarchal hierarchy happened where, like, we would sit down to dinner and none of the women were allowed to eat or serve themselves until he had served himself and my dad had served himself and taken a bite, and then the women were allowed to. Even with my 10-year-old brain, I knew that was really messed up.
You know, the thing that strikes me about what you're saying in the direction that we're going to speak about is you were, because of people speaking a different language and because of relatives moving over, you were in an observational outsider status, mm-hmm. position to be someone who's peeking at stuff, mm-hmm. that's so different from you, that actually came pretty early to you.
That outsider feeling. Well, the other side of that is, mm-hmm. that then this was, you remember, there was a hostage crisis. Mm-hmm. There was, Iran was the evil place, you know. And because suddenly all these relatives moved in with us, all our friends, everyone around us, everyone at school suddenly twigged, like, oh, she's an outsider. She's part of this evil, mm-hmm. Iranian thing. And so not only did I not fit in at home, but suddenly I was suddenly very weird at school and with my friends. And so, yeah, so I guess I could say I doubled down on my freak status at that point because I didn't belong anywhere. And in my home, you know, the English wasn't the dominant language. And yeah.
And so what was moving into adolescence like for you with all these complicated dimensions?
Yeah. I really rebelled hard. So my mom left. My mom couldn't handle it. All the stuff going down at home. And also my dad was a really difficult person to live with because he was angry and intense and controlling. And there was just a lot that, you know, okay, probably an American woman just was like, yep, that's it. I'm out. I don't blame her at all. And then she left. And then eventually my relatives got their own homes like right down the road, you know, so we didn't have them all in the house all the time. But when she left, then I kind of became mom to my sisters because my dad was working.
My question is, so your mom moved out, but you guys stayed with your dad?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a nasty divorce battle.
Was that, do you mind my asking, was it not her choice? Did your dad insist on you guys staying with him? Or?
Yeah. Yeah.
That must have been hard.
Yeah, it was hard. But that was when I started to act out. And also there was a lot of pressure on me as the oldest, and he would like cry on my shoulder and stuff, which is, when you're like 11, that's, you just don't have the facility to process that and deal with that. So my reaction was to just say, screw this. And so I started getting stoned and wearing like torn up clothes, like exactly the opposite of what he wanted me to be. I went for it. And I kept journals at the time. I got these crazy journals, you know, and in one of them I wrote, here's my goals. Want number one, sex. Number two, drugs. Number three, rock and roll, you know? And so I set out to accomplish this list of goals. And so, yeah, so like at age 11, I got a boyfriend and we kind of did it, you know? Not really, but like we went through the motions of trying to do it so I could just, you know, check it off my list. The drugs, you know, California, I was in basically the Bay Area. It's very easy to get marijuana in the 70s, you know, early 80s. And also, you know, I could just walk up to the gas station and buy a pack of cigarettes at age 11 and nobody would bat an eye. So I'd steal my dad's money from his suit pockets and go and buy cigarettes. And like I was a tough girl.
You were already in adolescent rebellion at 11, so.
At 11.
Going for it.
I'd gotten my period at age 9, so I started everything early.
Well, it sounds like you got pushed forward a little bit as the oldest daughter to be more grown up, but then you said no to it in a big way.
No.
Started to head
out. I said no. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and the harder I did that, the harder he freaked out and tried to control me. And now, you know, I'm a parent. I totally get it. You see your kid turning into this stoned, angry monster who runs away from home and hangs out with bad boys and stuff. Yeah, you know, you're going to freak out. And so it just got worse. Mm. I ran away from home and there was a whole story with the cops and all that stuff. And anyway, I eventually went to live with my mom, which was so much better. And she had married this guy named Bruce, who was this like hippie guy who had been in Vietnam. And he was like really political, listened to KPFA. And so KPFA was always on the Berkeley station. That was, you know, kind of radical radio at the time. And so I started to really think about something other than myself. Mm-hmm. And I'd start going to protests and the Pride Parade in San Francisco. And, you know, so I think I transferred my anger and my rage at my dad, although that actually has not really ever left me, but I kind of pointed it more towards anger at, you know, Ronald Reagan and nuclear annihilation and apartheid and all those things from the day. And I became a much different kid, still rebelling hard. And I was taking pictures. And so the photography thing started way, way earlier than that, when I was, I would say probably like second grade, I found a camera in a garage sale. And it was just a little Instamatic thing where you put the cartridge in. If I was good, my mom would buy me film and little flash cubes. And I'd take pictures of my friends and my cats and all that stuff. So so by the time I got to be, you know, like 11, 12, I had been taught how to use a real camera, film camera, and was then going to Berkeley in San Francisco and taking pictures of these people on the street. I was super influenced by Deanne Arbus. So she used to do these street portraits of people who were, you know, definitely on the fringes and unusual, and she'd catch people in these amazing moments. And so I was super inspired and started to do that. Probably this was right before high school when I was really taking pictures out in the world.
So it sounds like by the time you got to high school, this was already a really important way you had of expressing yourself, was through photography.
Oh yeah, for sure, because at that point I could learn how to use a darkroom. And so I took the darkroom. It was like the school newspaper class, but so they had a darkroom, so I did that and started photographing people in the high school. I still have these things up on my website, these pictures, very Deanne Arbus looking pictures, and I love them because, you know, I could see little baby photographer me working things out.
Very
and
cool.
And again, you know, finding the edge. I was already trying to find the edges of society and people who didn't live in the sort of prescribed normal lives that I was still rebelling so hard against.
So then you went to San Francisco State to study art photography, or?
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so it seemed obvious that I would start with photography, and I started in the art department. It was fine, but I think in the end I wasn't an art photographer. It wasn't about me. The photos weren't about something I was trying to express. I was trying to document and capture some sort of truth out in the world. I wanted to show people's souls, you know. I wanted people to, Salgado once said, you know, that you, in his photographs, people, it's like these people stepping up to a microphone to speak to the world through the photograph. And I loved that idea, and I felt like that was more my focus. So it took me a while. I was in the art department for probably a year before I realized, hey, there's a photojournalism department here, and there's this incredible professor there who literally wrote the textbook on photojournalism, Ken Cobry. And I went over there and talked to him and realized, yeah, this is what I need. And so I switched to photojournalism, and then everything just really took off from there.
So around that time you were in a band, you started Yeasty Girls back then?
Yeah, that was 1988 was when I was in this punk scene in Berkeley at Gilman Street. There was like all kinds of boy bands, but hardly any females up on stage. So it was really a guy scene. And there was a of course the Beastie Boys were really, really popular right then, and a couple of friends and I decided, wouldn't it be funny to start a band called the Yeasty Girls? And Jane, one of my friends, ran off, wrote this song called Yeast Power. And we were at a show, and in between bands, we jumped up on stage and just did this a cappella rap that we hadn't even practiced. We just had them, like, in our shaking hands, the lyrics. And I think it might be too I don't think the FCC would like this if I sang this song. but I think actually I could do the first line if you want.
Yeah, tell me the first line.
We're the yeasty girls and we got yeast power. We don't shave our armpits and we don't shower. We don't say thank you and we don't say please. We put things in our vaginas that you wouldn't believe. So that was our first, and there it goes on. But what was cool about it was you had all these like super punk dudes in this club, and they thought that, you know, nothing could unpunk them. But like, we get up on stage and start singing about our vaginas and yeast infections and stuff, and they're like recoiling and running out the door. And so we realized, wow, we really hit on something here. This is punker than punk. In my early years, I think I strove to be punker than punk. And I think the Yeasty Girls was the beginning of that, where we realized the power of speaking the truth and being as open as possible, like to a fault.
Into the discomfort of others. I mean, right?
Like, into, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was very unusual then, right? So now I think we're all used to it because there's lots of performers and writers and stuff who talk about this stuff. But in 1988, it was, we were sort of breaking new ground, and it was even pre-Riot Girl. Yeah. So that's kind of, that's where I'm coming from as I go into university. I've already, you know, in the middle of that, the Yeasty Girls thing.
And so this is around the time when the Lusty Lady comes into your life. That
right.
you start to work, and I think that kind of sensibility you're talking about punker than punk. And can you tell a little bit about that place specifically, about Lusty Lady?
Well, and I mean, if I could just back up a little bit, so as I went into the photojournalism studies, we went through a lot of film and a lot of paper in the darkroom to print everything, to shoot everything. You're shooting a lot, and with film, you know, everything's expensive. And I had been working in an office part-time to get through college, and I had some friends who were stripping at the Lusty Lady. And at the time, you know, San Francisco had quite a few strip clubs, but the Lusty Lady was known as kind of the feminist strip club. One, because it was owned and run by women. And two, because you didn't have to touch anybody. You were behind glass, so it was a peep show. And it was kind of, it felt sort of like you had your own agency in a way. You never felt like you had to compromise your selfhood by letting someone touch you so you could get more tips and all that. And so it attracted a lot of women who were going through college, getting their PhDs, going through law school, you know, that sort of thing, very political. And compared to some of the other places in town where there's lots of fake breasts and, you know, kind of that Barbie doll looking ideal, there was some of the fake stuff, but it wasn't encouraged necessarily at that point.
Is this the still, we're still in the Mitchell Brothers era, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that had a pretty big, had a certain vibe, which was not what you're talking about.
No, it was very different, yeah. I mean, if you wanted to make $1,000 a night, you could go over there, but you would also have to do a lot more, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And so my friends were stripping, and they'd come back with these incredible stories about the men who would come in and the fantasies that they'd enact through glass. You know, it wasn't like a dominatrix sort of situation where you're tying somebody up or anything like that. But at the Lusty Lady, you had a stage, which was basically a mirrored room. Then there was all these windows, and the windows were these booths that men could go in from the hallway, and they put in a quarter, and the little panel would slide up, and they could watch us through the glass dancing. There's usually, I think, four or five of us in there at a time, just sort of writhing around and showing our parts to the window. And so that was the stage show. And then there was a thing called the private pleasures booth. That was different. That was $5 for 3 minutes. I would be sitting in a booth, and then the customer would go into their own booth, and then we'd shut the doors and shut the curtains, and we could see each other through a big glass window, and we could hear each other. And they would put in the money for just a regular show where I would take off my clothes and wriggle around and stuff. But if they wanted me to do extra things, so I could do a show for them for an extra $10. And then, you know, there were the things if they wanted to act out fantasies or do, I don't know what, then it would cost extra. And that was where you get the interesting stories from the customers. And I'm just going to go ahead and say it, but they're mostly men. So, you know, mostly the male customers come in. And there were some women, but usually they were in couples, like on a Friday night. And that was always way more fun. But that didn't happen very often.
You're listening to KBOO. 90.7 FM, Portland Radio. If you're just joining us, our guest today is photojournalist Cami Talui, speaking about her book, $5 for 3 minutes.
So can you read a paragraph from the text of the book?
Yeah. There were plenty of regulars with very specific fantasies that they wanted to unleash in the booth. Backstage in the undressing room, the dancers would swap notes on these customers, and I realized that many didn't like dealing with them, so I suggested they send them to me. The stranger, the better, as far as I was concerned. I'd always felt like an anthropologist studying unusual people, spying them on the street and taking their picture, stopping to watch them in a shop, or, if I was lucky, following them home to photograph them in their natural habitat. I always felt like I was the weird, perverted kid in my family, and eventually I proudly took this on as part of my identity. So I felt an affinity with these customers who the other dancers thought were too strange. Plus, it made my shifts more interesting, meeting these curious characters, always with the possibility that I might be able to photograph them.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So tell me more about feeling like an anthropologist.
Actually, you know, I didn't mention it, but when I first went to university, my first major was anthropology, of like for one semester, because that's how I felt. I felt like I wanted to study humanity. And I also took photography and then realized, okay, yeah, it's got to be photography. I accepted a lot of behaviors that most people would not be able to even, they'd run out the door screaming. You know?
Were you surprised by your level of acceptance?
No, because I was here. I'd been through a lot in childhood. And then the yeast cereals thing really opened me up to being as honest as I could about stuff that freaked people out.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of just an extension of that. Being a stripper was kind of an obvious, even though the yeasty girls, you could say it was really feminist. And so there's that, especially then there was a whole thing where if you were feminist, you were also not very sex positive. Those two things were really separate, because a lot of feminists then would try and shut down strip clubs, you know, and lots of things like that. So being a sex positive feminist was kind of a radical act. Mm. And then by the time the late 80s and early 90s came around, especially in San Francisco, where there was a lot of people were in the sex industry. And of course, you know, there was the LGBT at the time. It actually, at the time, it was lesbian and gay. Like, I think that was pretty much all anyone ever said at that point. But you know, that really, that it opens up the city in a way because that community was so strong and is a big part of my life as well, because I eventually came to being to realize that I was bisexual and that I was part of that group as well. And so, yeah, I think those customers were, it felt like I was part of their family in a way.
One thing you describe is when you were describing the sort of mechanics of being in the booth, you describe the central interaction you have sort of like a dialogue between bodies, as giving the customer behind the glass full genital view of you so that they can masturbate. And one of the things I was thinking was this radical act you put in place, then you bring a camera to. And so that, I think of this is the punk moment, is where you the setup is the function of you are to be gazed at in the most personal way you possibly could for the purposes of that person. And into that moment, you entered with the camera and reversed it, the gaze.
Yeah.
So looking back on it now, that's what I mean by performance art, punk, liberation, sex positivity. How does it feel and look to you now?
Yeah, like all those things still. I mean, I guess, so if I were to rewind a little bit, the impetus for doing that was my love of photojournalism. So I had been working there for about a year before I brought my camera in. And up to that point, I never thought it was even possible to do that. I wouldn't have even tried had it not been for Ken Cobrey in his class. And the class that semester was about the photo story and telling the story, an extended story through imagery. And early on that semester, the assignment was to go home and photograph your life for a week. Everything you do, document it. You are the topic of the story. And I went home and thought, oh, crap, how am I going to do this, you know? And so I asked a friend to come in and just come into the booth and let me photograph him, and then just be done with it, right? Because I thought, oh, God, I'll lose my job if they find out. So I'll just quickly take a picture and that'll be it. But thankfully, he didn't show up. And so there I was at work in the booth with my camera. And I thought, okay, well, because I'm a very good student, I thought, well, I need to fulfill this assignment. And so I got up the nerve, and the first customer came in. I said, okay, it's $5 for 3 minutes to watch me strip. And if you want me to do a show, it's an extra $10, but if you let me take your picture, the show is free. And that was just something I just came up with on the spur of the moment, just thinking, oh, how am I ever going to convince anybody to do this except to bribe them with like a cheap deal, you know? The surprising thing was that first guy said yes. And not only did he say yes, but he loved it. You know, he loved that I guess he thought, maybe he thought that I thought he was so hot that I wanted to take his picture or something. That's the male ego. There's a lot of things at play there, because number one, I was a young woman, and as a young woman, nobody really gives you credit for having any sort of power or agency, or don't, you know, especially in that scenario where you're just a stripper. You know, and I'm saying that in quotes, you're just a stripper. Therefore, you know, she's probably a drug addict. These pictures will, you know, whatever. And I did, I was totally honest. I said, I'm shooting them for school, you know, my university assignment. I think it was not scary to them. I mean, a lot of men said no. Okay, so not everybody thought it was okay, but they just didn't feel threatened by me. And then some of them loved the attention, like that first guy. He came back the following week saying, you got your camera? because like he wanted me to take more pictures of him. So that was a really important lesson to me as a photographer, and actually just in life, that you just don't know until you ask. You never know. People might say yes, and then great, keep going. So that was a big lesson, and I did keep going. And I didn't get fired because I didn't tell anybody. Well, the other dancers knew I was doing it, but I didn't let the management know because I didn't want to lose my job.
Mm-hmm. You answered the question about what was liberating in your work. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, well, it does go back to what you're saying about reversing the gaze. So yes, I was being objectified. I allowed myself to be objectified. So that's number one, is that, you know, yes, in porn, the woman is objectified, but I chose to do that. I was paid really well there, and that allowed me to have an apartment and afford film and paper. And this was San Francisco, right? I guess it wasn't as expensive then, but it gave me the power to do what I wanted to do. And so these men would come in and they would watch me, but in the booth especially, it was a back and forth. It was a collaboration. So I was an active participant. But then to bring the camera in and reverse the gaze, that gave me even more power. And I hate the word power. It's not about power. I think maybe agency is a better word, because I don't feel like I needed power, you know, in the sense of like some
oppression,
mad superhero or something. Yeah. But it meant that, well, I mean, that point in time, my photography was really taking off, and that series was a big part of it. I was shooting lots of other stuff at the time too. Mm-hmm. I was riding around in an ambulance taking pictures. I was doing other sex related stories. I went to Soviet Union and photographed punks in the Soviet Union. You know, so I did lots of stuff. But this one was getting a lot of attention because I think no one had ever really done this before. Because the photographs of in strip clubs was always of the women. But to show the experience of the woman and how the men were acting and treating this was new. And so the arrangement of a strip club is basically, you know, it's about money and it's about who has the power in the situation. The man has the money, the woman needs the money. And so there's that capitalist element, and then you have the patriarchy, which is this system that allows men to move in these worlds basically in secrecy. So everybody knows that there's these strip clubs or video houses or massage parlors and all that stuff. Everybody knows about those things, but they don't really know what goes on in there. And everyone just sort of, you know, accepts it, that men have this world in which they can go in, and with their money, they can tell women, you know, turn around, I want to see it, you know, see your butt, that sort of, all those sorts of things, you know? And so that was just very secret, and that's the patriarchy. So we have capitalism and patriarchy meeting together in a strip club. And then there I was taking pictures of these things that happen in the shadows, of what the men actually do, what actually goes on in these places where the men have this agency, this power to do what they do. And so I think that was kind of, well, not kind of, that was super taboo. And I think that it was pretty shocking to some people to see, you know, to see a man masturbating is shocking, because when men are in that state, they look vulnerable. They look, they, a lot of people say to me, they see the pictures and they think the men look sad, like not sad like boohoo, but pitiful. Mm. And so to expose a man in this vulnerable moment is a kind of act against the patriarchy and against the kind of accepted power of, you know, how our society is set up, basically. I didn't set out to expose men and make them feel emasculated and pitiful. Like that wasn't my aim at all, to make them look pitiful. Like, to me, it was because I'm a journalist and I want to show what's really going on.
I'd agree. I think that's what's so beautiful about the book is you broke a rule, is what it felt like. You broke an unspoken rule that only one side of the sexual gratification transaction is allowed to be exposed. And you brought the lens wider so that both participants in the exchange were documented, and it went against some unspoken thing that I agree with you is probably about power and the power, who has the gaze, who has the power, and who has the funding or whatever. But you broke that by presenting the bigger world of it. So in a way, it was true. It's a beautiful truth telling, and made people uncomfortable. You're listening to KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland Radio. If you're just joining us, our guest today is photojournalist Cami Talui, speaking about her book, $5 for 3 Minutes. So I wanted to talk a little about your work was soon noticed, and you made connections with curators, getting into the Bad Girls show at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York, but things went a little unexpected. The reception of your work speaks to this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. People were drawn to it and terrified by it. People wanted to see it and show it, but the environment at the time, especially, this was, this when Ed Meese was doing his thing? There was a lot of censorship, and the government was trying to shut down the funding to the arts. To the NEA. It was really a dark time. There was a lot of censorship, and a lot of galleries and museums of getting their funding cut because they dared to show something that the Republicans thought was offensive. And so that was the environment where I was trying to show this work. This show back, I sent off a photo to see if I could be in Bad Girls, and they accepted me on the condition that they would build this big wooden booth and project slides of the images on the inside, and they would make people look through little peepholes in the wood to look at it, right? So they wanted to show the work, but they were terrified about showing the work. And they wanted to make sure that no children could see it, right? And I don't know what children would be going to this thing, but anyway.
When you first described it in your book, I thought it was sort of like a performative thing to put the wood up as a way of sort of making it, what's the word, implicating the person by making them look through a peephole, implicating the viewer. But I hear what you're saying. There's another dimension where it was fear and hiding it.
They presented it to me as an installation so that the viewer would be implicated in the gaze, work, and that they would be peeping through a hole to look at it. But the truth of it was that they were so terrified of it that they didn't even put a description of what the work was. They put my name on it, but they didn't, there was no way for anyone looking at it to know what they were looking at. And so I flew out to New York for the opening. And when I saw what they had done, I tried to get the attention of the curator. And so I couldn't, and I tried to get someone to, you know, promise me that they would put something on there. Because what happened was I was standing next to it, this basically this blank wall with holes in and my name on it, and listening to what people were saying. And one woman was like, I don't know, it looks like they're on the toilet. And I was, oh, so mad, because everything about the work was lost when someone would look at it and think I was just shooting people on the toilet.
Well, it's also the intention of the artist. I mean, you are the author of the work, and to have it presented in a way that doesn't reflect how you want it to be experienced, it really seems like it got taken out of your hands.
Mm-hmm. It was either that or not be in the show. That was what they said. And so, of course, that being my second show ever, I was like, yeah, okay. Because I thought that they would respect the work and do it right. I've always had kind of tension between what I do and the art world.
Mm.
And because, and photojournalism, I think, has always been sort of held separate from art, the world of galleries and all that. And so this work really straddles both, and I've always felt that kind of pressure to, gosh, do I have to write one of those artist statements that sounds like, you know, art speak with all those big words and things, making it slightly impenetrable to people who don't know those big words, that sort of thing that I can't stand, because I just want everything to be plain and obvious and the truth about stuff. So that was a big eye opener for me. I've since been in other big. I had two images at the Tate Modern, in a big show in 2010, and also went to San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. The thing about that is, so in that and other shows that I've been in, is the curators again love the work, but they're terrified of it, and they end up choosing the really safe images, so the ones without penises in. And like, that's not really what the work isn't about that, because do they choose there's one super safe image of this fully clothed couple staring at me through the glass like they're watching television, or, you know, pictures of me and you can see my breasts, because breasts are so safe. Breasts are like, that's the patriarchy right there, you know. It's like, yeah, show us breasts. That's good, but all that other stuff, don't show that stuff. I've had quite a few shows where they would be too afraid to show what the work really is about. And I, a few years ago, decided, right, that's it. I'm not going to be in any show that does this to my work again, because it's, again, I'm dealing with people being too afraid, and I won't take part in anything that censors. I won't censor my own work like that, in other words.
Mm-hmm. One,
and finding a publisher was also hard,
mm-hmm,
for the same reasons.
Well, one of the things that you said was, I felt I'd captured an unexamined side of the human condition.
Mm.
What is it you think it's being missed when you're trying to present that? That unexamined side. I'd love to hear more about what your thoughts are about that.
When was the last time you saw anything that showed honest male sexuality? You know, bare bones, honest, emotional, vulnerable male sexuality? Almost never.
Mm-hmm.
Really, even today, almost never. And that's half the world.
Yeah, that was my question. Is, have you even seen this change at all over time?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I finally was able to find a publisher after almost 30 years of trying. Is that how long it was? It finally took going to a publisher that had a woman, you know, in the decision-making process. And they're European as well, so I think that also is a factor, because I think America still has this prudishness that you don't find in Europe. And I lived in England for 10 years, and that's how I found this publisher. Otherwise, I would have loved to publish it in America, where people in America could actually purchase it. It's very hard to purchase it here because it was published in Greece and blah, blah, blah. It continues to this day, that difficulty. But then I've also had, you know, pretty high profile interviews in The Guardian and blah, blah, blah. So they weren't that scared of it. So things have changed.
It seems like part of the commentary in the difficulty getting your work out in the U.S. is it's a very particular American, I don't know what we'd call it, shame and prudishness squished together, that becomes this big censoring process that happens anytime you try to promote your work to move it into the public.
Yeah, and you never are really that as aware of it as you are if you live in another culture that doesn't have that, you know, and you look at it from afar and you realize, my God, America still has that, what is it called? The puritanical belief system that formed this country is still with us. And I mean, all you have to do is look to what's happening now with women's rights and abortion and everything else that's going to come at us now with this minority of people who think that women shouldn't be doing the things that I'm doing, that you're doing, that all of those things. So I'm glad I'm back in America, actually, because I want to continue pushing against that, and pushing against it from Europe isn't as good. There's a harder edge to push against, for sure.
Well, also, I think it's such an amazing moment to be talking to you about this beautiful, radical thing that you did to name, like, the male gaze just eclipses everything, and when it gets reversed, it sort of falls apart.
And my relationship, that one-on-one, you know, even if it was just 3 minutes, you become instantly intimate with somebody, even if it's just 3 minutes. And somehow that was easier to navigate.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like it's pure experience and a dialogue between two bodies and two participatory bodies. And what gets learned about each other. I feel like that's one of the beautiful things about the book, is you brought an observational element to that. And it's the only time I've ever heard of that. You know, that becomes a kind of a gift of bringing truth to a moment like that. And like you were saying, what do you end up with? Emotional truth, emotional vulnerability. And then once it gets to the outside world, it's then it gets judged. But before that, that's where I saw you located, in this sort of non-judgmental outsider moment with another person, bringing all of yourself to it. So it's an exceptional thing. I find what you did amazing.
Oh, thank you. You know, I really wish that more women would do what I did. I don't want to be the only woman who's done this. I'm fine with being the first, but I want more women to turn the gaze on what their lives are and what's really happening for them. And lots of women are doing it. I'm not saying that they're not, but I think with something so simple can be so radical. And also, not just that, but it can change society. Photography has that power. And if enough people who don't have much power were able to do that, I feel like that would be this opening and inspiring. It would be great. And I have met younger photographers who said that my work inspired them, and I'm so pleased by that. I mean, what else do you want in life, right?
Well, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you, Cami. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was really fun. Let's do it again.
Thanks for listening to this week's Between the Covers with me, your host, Avi Marr, with musical help from John Bechtel. Thank you.